Talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. This is the Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Alan Miller, and in this second part of the show, we're going to be looking at some of the ways that we understand things, some of the ways that things are presented. We spoke to Jay Bhattacharya about the approach, how certain things were weaponized during COVID. And now we move into a new, what some people like to call a new normal. I hate that term, but obviously it's very different since we've been through the experience of COVID. And often, though, what was happening even before COVID were people saying, show me the data, tell me the evidence. This is evidence-based policy. Now, even when people had said that, it was sometimes an excuse to not have a political discussion, and even maybe sometimes a moral discussion, but a discussion about the virtue of something. But at least it had the merit of saying, well, what is the evidence that might inform any decision? And we've seen that data has been used in many ways and presented in many ways, and along with nudge and impositions, has been weaponized. We all know the old adage, there's lies, damn lies and statistics, but data is always used in any discussion. You can't help but see lots of quotes in the press. Whenever anyone's ever making a case for something, they'll say this amount and this amount. But someone that's been very good at being able to break down and do what used to be called a Fisking after Robert Fisk, but do a breakdown of the assumptions behind the data and also looking at them, because he's got a lot of experience in having done that when he worked at the ONS, where he was the head of health, jobs and wages, as well as doing a stint at the BBC, is the political and economic commentator and statistician, I can never say that word properly, Jamie Jenkins. Many of you will know him from his social media posts and his media appearances. We're great. We've got him here today. Thanks for joining us, Jamie.
Good afternoon, Alan. Don't worry, a lot of people struggle with the word statistician. You know, it's quite common.
It's, yeah, us Londoners, us Southerners, we can't speak properly. You know that's true anyway. Jamie, just there's so many things that, I mean, it's almost like, I want to ask you this question because, you know, I ask this of everyone, but like what was there kind of any kind of key point in during the COVID response or what had happened in the early days that led, that was a kind of light bulb? I was like, what is going on? Or a real red light going on, or a kind of warning signs? What was it that for you, was it something based in stats and data that you looked at, or was it something else? Just tell us.
Yeah, well, I suppose the first few months of the pandemic, I pretty much, like most of the public, was just kind of observing what was kind of going on. My mates would be sending me some WhatsApp messages about some stuff. And then you were seeing these daily death figures coming out across the media. And because I used to run the team at the Office for National Statistics that produced death statistics, I thought, well, let's look into this a little bit more. And then we tended to get quite frequently, didn't we? We'd have these briefings that were, in the United Kingdom, and I'm sure other countries had similar things as well, where you'd have the Prime Minister stepping up and then he'd pass over to the kind of Chief Medical Officer, which is Chris Whitty, or Sir Patrick Vallance, the Chief Scientific Officer at the time. And then they would be doing all these presentations, chucking up all of these charts and things. And to be frank, most of the population just wouldn't have understood most of what they were talking about, because people don't really engage with data and statistics on a day-to-day basis. And there was one shocking one. I think I was talked to quite a bit on the media after this. It was quite rare for, I think, to have one of these press conferences on a Saturday evening, but I can't even remember which lockdown this one was probably going to enforce, Alan, but it was a Saturday evening, 6 o'clock, and normally people would be sitting down and watch prime time television, but I think the BBC took a live press conference from Boris Johnson with Whitty and Vallance again. And it was just chart after chart. Next slide, please. Next. It's like a doomsday scenario as if the world's going to end. And I was struggling to understand some of the data that they were presenting at the time. I'm thinking, if I'm struggling here, are they deliberately trying to confuse the public into, oh, look, this is already bad, we need to do something? Or genuinely, were they just trying to pull a load of slides together, stick them out in the best way they could? And that was the thing. I'm very critical of that presentation, though, Alan. And I think from there on in, we kept getting really very strange. I think the one thing that kind of opened my eyes a little bit more was on the vaccination rollout. And I think it was around the winter of last winter, I think, actually, where you were getting lots of people claiming how many people were in intensive care who were unvaccinated. And the data didn't bore that out. People were saying like 90% of patients in intensive care with COVID today are unvaccinated. And then you'd get, you had Martin Kemp on ITV coming up. I think, why is Martin Kemp talking about these things? And the figures at the time, Alan, it was closer to 36%, not 90%. And so to me, why were these numbers all being chucked down the throat of people to say, basically people were lying on TV about the data, and the data was different to what he was saying. And it all seemed to be kind of this nudge to go and get people vaccinated. So those were the kind of the critical moments for me, I think.
Yeah. And I mean, do you think that they were basically lying means that you know that something's not true and you say it anyway? Do you think that was what was happening? Or do you, some people will say that, well, they're presented with all this different data. They've got scientists, they've got civil servants, they've got stats people that do know maybe much more about the data, but it's being presented in a certain way and presenting data in a certain way. Well, what's your take on it?
Yeah, well, so let's break down Boris Johnson last winter, his kind of Christmas address. And this isn't at the start of the pandemic now. You know, you're talking, where we coming towards the 2022 now, and pretty much we were kind of a year and a half or whatever, really a good chunk of the pandemic, Alan, had gone on. And Boris Johnson says in his Christmas address, we need to get that booster that stops us infecting others. Now, at the start of the pandemic, people didn't really know when the vaccines first rolled out. There was this whole confusion. A lot of people were saying that vaccination would stop you infecting others. That's part of the rationale that people were kind of pushing vaccine passports, which I know you was against. I was against at the time because we knew that the data didn't support that. So for Boris Johnson, the Prime Minister, who, come on, this isn't a layperson. He should be all over this. He's running the COVID response. For him to say, get this booster vaccination, not the first, not the second, and we're talking about the third one. Get this booster vaccination that stops us infecting others. Well, that's blatantly false. So I think you can't say at that time he wouldn't have known that that was wrong, but he was happy to go and talk about it. Some of the other celebrities, I suppose, who were saying the vast majority of patients in intensive care are unvaccinated, they're probably just repeating what has been said by other people. So they were probably saying it in good faith, but there wasn't really a lot of people calling this up at the time. I was doing a lot of Twitter stuff trying to call this out, and there was a lot of complaints to Ofcom about Dr. Hilary Jones putting out misleading statistics on this. I think they decided not to proceed with an investigation, even though there were 3,000 complaints there, Alan. Partly, I think, because if it's Ofcom are happy with the way the misinformation is going out, they don't seem to want to investigate, though. So yeah, I think Doris, clearly, he would have known at the time that the vaccine didn't stop you infecting others. But yet, it wasn't a throwaway comment on a TV, on a clip when he's been caught unawares. This was his address to the nation for his Christmas. Surely that's gone through how many loops to get, sign off of script and things. But on it wouldn't be,
absolutely.
A moment there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the thing is that we were... This is a situation where if you're in charge of things, you can insist on having everything at your fingertips. This is all that you're doing, right? The country's shut. You've shut the country down. What is going? I want all the stats. I want all the information. I want to see it real. Not models, not projections. Stop showing me models and projections now. I need to know. And it's inexcusable. And we know. And so I agree with you. But I mean, we were that weaponizing of all that, as you describe. I mean, it was a night after night of these kind of warlike press conferences where we only saw one thing being discussed. And this is the other thing about context. Most people, because why would they, right? Why would anyone who's going about their daily business know this unless you're interested in stats or you're in health, that arena? But they don't know how many people are born and die every day, right? They don't know how many people get cancer and die on a daily, weekly, monthly basis. And there aren't any comps or anything. So that was the other thing, wasn't it? It wasn't contextualized. There wasn't a discussion about flu normally and COVID and then cancer and heart and stroke. And there wasn't any discussion about the consequences of any of these measures and what they might do to those things. It was in a vacuum, wasn't it?
Yeah, no, you're right there. And I think when you start quoting big numbers, it's quite clear. We were seeing higher than expected deaths, excess deaths at the time in March 2020. And it got quite bad in the winter of 2020, going into 2021 as well in the United Kingdom and across many nations across the world. But I think for me, though, there was always, you know, the critical thing, thinking of the modeling, Alan, is that when they had the first kind of models that were coming out saying how many deaths, you know, Armageddon and things. So what happened then is the government reintroduces a kind of a response to that. So the lockdown, that's what we all kind of think. So then you can't mark the homework because you can't check if what the model said would happen because the government's done something. So you can't. But what happened then when we went into kind of winter of 2022 time, this was now, where there was Boris Johnson was under a lot of pressure from, you know, the usual suspects of the think tank or the, you know, the pressure group Independent Sage or across the media all the time saying, no, we need more lockdowns. And it was around the Christmas period where they said, look, if we don't have more lockdowns, you know, or further restrictions, probably is the best thing to say at this point in time, we're going to see large numbers of deaths this winter. We've got, because I think it was the time the Omicron wave hit the country, Alan. I mean, are we going to huge infections and stuff? And fair play, I think Boris, give him some due, he decided not to do that, partly because of the pressure on the backbenchers. And so that was the first time, Alan, we could mark the modelling because the government did not do what the modellers were saying. If you don't do this, this is going to happen. So we tracked it, we looked at it. And then what we found a couple of months later, where we got through that Omicron wave, the deaths, the actual deaths were 93% lower than what the modellers were saying. So if you think early on in the pandemic, it was as bad as that. A lot of government, because remember, it was government ministers making the decisions based on the modelling. If the modelling was that bad when we could mark it, you know, we were probably making a lot of poor decisions based on very raw or, you know, very dodgy data that was presented to government at the time.
Now, you've worked at the ONS, right? So you, and the question is, and people, loads of people have asked this question, but I'll put it to you. We saw with the both with swine flu, and we saw with mad cow's disease, and we saw that there was modelling done, predictions basically, right? It's like a gambling prediction, right? An idea, and you put something out, and they were very wide of the mark. And that we'd seen that in specifically Professor Neil Ferguson and Imperial, that those models, and they'd resulted in things and consequences, and the question becomes, why, in your opinion, was there such an obsession with the modelling? And also, if there was to be obsession with the modelling, with that particular kind of modelling, because other people had put forward models as well. What's your take on it?
Yeah, so the modelling tends to be done outside of the government agencies generally. So like the ONS wouldn't have been doing any of the modelling. They would be responsible for kind of publishing what actually happened. They don't tend to model what's going on. And so the modelling's done by generally these universities. And yet there were a range of models being done at the time. And what kind of grabs the media's attention, because remember, the media are implicit in a lot of what was going on here, Alan, is that the newspapers in particular, what you tend to get there is that the newspapers will, like, you know, bad news sells. So they will always home in on a very bad model. And they'll say, you know, this new model from this college here is saying that we could get 500,000 deaths if we don't do anything. And obviously, the newspapers then drive a lot of the broadcast kind of media because they'll talk about what's on the front of the newspapers today. So that thing is kind of plastered all over the place. So ministers then are more fixated on that rather than, say, another model that says actually it's going to be 30,000, let's say, for argument's sake, rather than 500,000. So then you tend to then think, right, well, we need to avoid this worst case scenario. So we need to do something because we'll be seen really bad now if we don't act upon that. So I think, why is the modelling so far out in the first place? Well, sometimes there's garbage in and you get garbage out, sometimes, Alan, with some of these models. And it was just very poor. And for me, that the one I just told you about, the 93% lower, that was just so irresponsible. And I think we've got to learn a lesson from this because, you know, potentially there'll be further things in the future. But if we haven't learned from how bad things were modelled for this pandemic, you know, I think, what was we seeing? I think, Alan, you shared on Twitter as well the other day. You know, we've seen headlines about bird flu could kill 1 in 20 humans and get infected with new models and all this kind of stuff. Absolute nonsense, you know, these things. Just keep calm, carry on. So we've got to learn from the poor modelling, Alan. And you're right, some people were doing different models. They weren't being listened to because they weren't. It's kind of the doomsday scenario, I suppose.
But there's a danger of just being completely anti-scientific, right, and having a response to say, because a lot of people, trust has been broken. With a certain minority, trust is absolutely gone. With a significant chunk of the population, there's a lack of trust. There's a cynicism about politicians, about science, about data. I mean, it's important, right, that we have a handle on evidence, and that the two things aren't confused, modelling and evidence. I mean, just before we go to the break, if you could quickly, what do you think should be any inquiry or any, like, how we move forward? What should be done in terms of the question of evidence versus modelling?
Well, I think it's just a simple answer to that one, Alan, is that, you know, people, we need to see the books. We need to see what the decisions were. What was the data that was based upon? It needs to be all out in the public domain. We don't really know all the stuff that was going on in some of these kind of sage kind of meetings and things. And we need to see it all. And it needs to be probably scrutinized. But we also need to have, you know, proper scrutiny in terms of what things did they ignore as well, because they would have had more than just one thing on the table. That's what's critical, because then we can see, well, how poor were the decisions? Was it pretty much the politicians were drove down a specific road because of the data showing something? And if that was poor, we need an audit trail back as to why was it so poor in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, I talk about audit trails. Everyone knows if you make mistakes with things, or you purposely obfuscate or lie, you can be held up criminally if it's to do with accounts or anything else, if you're in business or as a citizen. We're going to come back to some of these issues. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Jamie Jenkins. This is TNT Radio. Join us just after this.
Celebrations of man's relationship with God going on. Our Jewish friends observing Passover, and Christians celebrating Christ's victory over death, not to mention our own eternal salvation. The message? Hope. Despite all the darkness being dished out by the forces of evil in this world, we still have hope. Have a blessed Easter. See you Monday on the Chris Salcedo Show on TNT Radio.
When a child is sick, there's one thing they need. A really big cookie.
Welcome to RMHC.
And parents of sick children have tons of decisions to make. Like movie night, game night, or should we finish that book tonight? We don't perform surgeries, just talent shows. We're not big on poking sticks and beeping machines, but we're the best at playing dress up. But we have a few beeping machines. We think the tooth fairy should travel everywhere. And while hospitals have doctors and nurses, we have mom and dad. We don't provide treatment, but we do provide dogs. And we throw some really good parties. Because at Ronald McDonald House Charities,
we are home.
We help families feel at home, even when they can't be. Donate today at rmhc.org/donate.
A message brought to you by TNT Radio.
CO2 sustains all life on Earth, but now it's in long-term decline. We face the return of an ice age. We mandate that the truth be told. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm Alan Miller. I'm here with Jamie Jenkins, who's an expert in stats and is a regular commentator in the media. And we were just talking about seeing the books, having a transparency, but obviously there was very little transparency in the last period. In fact, there was direct, not just attempts, there were direct censorship measures. There was shutdowns, impositions, shadow banning. We've seen all of that now. We've seen it in the Twitter files. We've seen it here in the lockdown files. Just briefly, has that impacted you at all? What in terms of your work or how things have been, or even in terms of censorship at all in any way?
No, I don't think I've ever been kind of censored, I suppose. But part of the, I think, rationale there is that, you know, given my background, when I'm putting statistics out to inform people, is a complete, and going back to what we just talked about, audit trail, all the links are all there. Anybody can check anything that I say. You know, I'm not going to, if I'm calling people out myself, fact-checking people. There was one instance, I suppose, I think I was on with Mark Stein on GB News once, and I think I was challenging him on something at the time, and then a fact check company on Facebook, because Facebook put a big plaster thing on there saying this is false. So I got in touch with them, showed them all the data, and threatened legal action because of everything I said. And actually, within 24 hours, they withdrew their fact check. So I think a lot of people are getting fact checked on these things. But if you're going to fact check, make sure you're fact checking the right thing. So other than that, I don't know, I've been pretty, well, I wouldn't say lucky.
Well, that's interesting. But... Now, just on that point, what were they using for their... Because this is the other thing. We've got these so-called fact-checkers that are actually sometimes look more like campaigning activists than fact-checkers.
Yeah, no, I think you're probably right. You've got lots of different organizations. I think it was fact-checking. Facebook seemed to have a company that does quite a lot of their fact-checking. And I can't remember the exact fact check it was now in particular. I haven't got my notes in front of me. But yeah, I just looked and thought, well, I've never had anybody plaster this. And what that meant is nobody could share, I think, the post that I'd put on Facebook. I never had any issues on the same information, ironically, is on Twitter. No issue whatsoever. Same information on Instagram, which is kind of owned by the same people as Facebook. No issue. And then on Facebook, they reckon there's some error on or some fact needed checking. So yeah, that would go... got withdrawn pretty quickly on that. But other than that, yeah, you're right, though. There's a lot of stuff that gets fact-checked. But some people only want to fact-check kind of half the debate as well. You know, so that's the thing for me is the bias with fact-checking, that maybe they'll only fact-check if somebody's saying, for example, you know, the vaccines are having specific harms, maybe some people will fact-check that. But then if there is some harms that are proven and somebody puts the other side of the, you know, they won't fact-check the other side of the debate. That, to me, is where fact-checking has gone wrong in the pandemic, I think.
Right. So on that note of harms, I know that, I just wanted to ask you, the first thing is that it looks like, and it's the points, the claims being made, that the side effects of the recent vaccinations for COVID, obviously there's a few different ones and then there's boosters as well, but the side effects are far higher. Some have said they're more than if you add up all the side effects of all the other previous procedures that sometimes took 10 years to develop. And so even though people say they're statistically still quite small relatively to the amount of people that have had them, they're still far higher than ever before. And actually, obviously, because so many have been administered, they're still quite high. What's your take on that?
Yeah, so I think so. With the vaccines that we've had, with this, there are first thing you've got to probably start with is there've been so many people vaccinated that even if it's a rare event to have kind of a serious adverse of kind of effect, you're going to start getting into large numbers of people, you know, into the thousands probably when you've vaccinated so many people. Because if you think of other vaccinations that we have, even just the flu vaccine as an example. You know, we haven't tried to roll a flu vaccine out across the whole population, and the flu vaccine take-up is generally lower anyway among the groups that are eligible for a kind of a free flu vaccination. So you've got that. But I suppose in terms of where we are with the harms, we did have some data from the ONS themselves a couple of weeks ago, Alan, where they've looked at, you know, vaccinations among people aged 12 to 29. And I think you've been talking about in the previous hour as well, especially when you start getting into younger people, because we know 88% of all the deaths linked to COVID over the last 3 years have been over the age of 65. So when you start going down that age profile, you know, you've got to then weigh up the risk and the reward of a vaccine. So the reward in terms of reducing your risk is much, much lower as you go down the age groups, because you're at a much, much lower risk at the start. So the ONS were looking at it, and they've looked across the age group as a whole, so 12 to 29 year olds across all different vaccinations. And they said they couldn't see any significant increase in deaths among vaccinated. But they did, when you look at it, when you start breaking it down into more granular, different types of vaccinations, different genders and stuff, they did find an elevated risk of death for kind of women who had a non-mRNA jab, which is mainly the AstraZeneca. And what the kind of they were showing there is that the risk was much, much higher to die within the first 12 weeks than the longer term risk, which I think it kind of meant that about one additional cardiac registered death related to the vaccine for every 16,500 females who age 12 to 29 in that first 12 weeks versus the long term. And it's the first time we've seen perhaps a government agency, the ONS is independent of government, but they're kind of still funded, I suppose, by the government, for a government agency to kind of come out and say that we've identified some actual harms ourselves with the vaccination. Now, they did withdraw the AstraZeneca vaccination quite early. So this wouldn't have probably been rolled out to the whole population. But for those who did have it, we have seen a thing. And it just seems to be a big reluctance across some parts of the media to even acknowledge, even if a coroner report says the death was caused by a vaccine, to even acknowledge that there are harms at all.
Yeah, well, that's definitely true. But tell me about the exit, because I want to get onto some of the other things that are happening in society at the moment, in the last, before the next break and towards the end of it. But what The excess deaths, how much is that in your opinion? Obviously, we all knew that things like cancer, heart disease, strokes would be built up. They go from, you know, first stage to fourth stage. If people get only, if it's an NH, if there's a COVID only NHS, people didn't go in. There was all sorts of measures, and many of us warned about that right at the start. So there are obviously things, but how much have you done a dive on these stats and what the excess deaths are and how you can identify them? What's your view on it?
Yeah, so we obviously had big excesses during that first wave and the second wave, and most of that is linked.
I'm sorry, just to clarify, I'm talking about now as well, excess deaths now. Yeah.
Yeah, and so, and then I'm just going to go on to now. So what we've seen probably from about week 19 of last year all the way through, pretty much high levels of excess deaths. And this isn't COVID now. That's what I was going to say. It was COVID early on in the pandemic, but this isn't COVID. And non-COVID excess deaths. And then when you start breaking it down by ages, Alan, you start seeing kind of higher than expected deaths. They seem to be more prominent when you take any COVID deaths out among people aged 35 to 54. And there's going to be a multitude of different factors. This is where you need proper kind of investigations in terms of, well, you're right, we've seen record waiting lists now in the NHS. People not going forward, being reluctant because they were told to stay home, protect the NHS, and maybe the government meant stay home so you don't catch an infection and then burden the NHS. But a lot of people stayed away from the NHS for other things, and that's going to be an issue there. There's obviously, we know that some people have died linked to vaccination, but I suppose to reassure people on one sense there, that this 35 to 54 age group, where we've been seeing these excess deaths, say the last 30, 40 weeks, they haven't, hardly any of them have been having vaccinations in that period. So if what we need to then understand is there are longer term impacts of, say, vaccinations there. We know from some studies that COVID itself can cause some longer term issues. So there's going to be a multitude of different factors at play here, Alan. And that's really what the government, if you look at the data at the moment, it's the excess deaths have been coming down over the last kind of month or so, but that's generally the older people. If you continue to look in the young, in across the age groups, we're still seeing these elevated deaths in these younger people. And remember, if somebody dies in their 30s, 40s, 50s, okay, it's one death is the same as somebody dying in their 70s, 80s, but the actual years of life lost is much, much greater, because obviously somebody in their 30s, you would expect to have at least another 40, 50 years worth of life.
Just the final question on this point. Whenever you see someone like a sports person or someone that's well known in the media and they're in their 30s to 50 or 20s to 50s, and we've just seen S Club 7 very sadly and everything, people, there's an impulse to, I think, amongst some, and I've had a couple of friends that this has happened with as well, or like, very sadly, but to say, to question, has that as a consequence of the jab, of the COVID vaccine? Have you seen stats that can reflect it? I know it's difficult with recording and all of that, and that's something we saw during COVID as well, but what's your take on it?
Yeah, well, I haven't seen much stats on this, to be honest with you, Alan. But you're right, you do see any death that's kind of sudden. Some people kind of link it to vaccinations. I obviously don't know vaccination status of these people. We need to have a really good understanding, but you've got to remember people, you know, sudden deaths, they do get kind of picked up a lot at the moment, but they've happened, you know, for decades as well. These things were happening long before kind of COVID hit us as well. So it's a difficult one without me looking into too much detail of all of the different stats on this, because I'm really, it's not really an area I've done much in on this one, Alan.
Yeah. So now we've gone through this pandemic, this whole like emergency stations, you're constantly in a state of fear and panic, and not the way to treat anything as it happens. It should be calm and rational and with a pandemic strategy. But now it seems that we're in a similar way quite often in the discussion around the environment, clean air, water, heat, if it's the weather or if it's energy. Just how much have you noticed this in the work you're doing now? I know that you've said things about reservoirs and the fears of drought, and just give us a couple of examples, maybe if you think of where you think similarities. If you do, if you think they're not, tell me, right? But if you know, if there are similarities with this kind of, we must be at a state of emergency and things must be done. It's almost like we've got this kind of continuation of a certain approach, right? It seems to me. I don't know what you think.
Yeah, we've gone from kind of thinking this from a UK perspective. We've had years of the Brexit debate. Then we had the COVID debate. And now that's kind of good, thank God, kind of coming towards the end, back end of all of that. We're constantly now, and it's been going on for decades as well, I suppose, the environment. But the environmental debate is all one-sided, you know, that everybody has to hit this kind of net zero target and everything's blamed on climate change. And the things you've alluded to there, you take the UK, that we've increased in population the last 30 years, 10 million people. We've not built a reservoir for the last 30 years. And in fact, we've been reducing them. Welsh Water in 2022, you know, last year, Alan, said they didn't need one of the reservoirs in Denbighshire, so they turned it back to a natural lake. So we haven't increased our infrastructure. We've increased the population. We've reduced, say, our water kind of coverage with some reservoirs. But then we got these excess droughts because of climate change, and this is the new normal. And you think back to the Victorians. Well, if this is the new normal then, why aren't we planning for it? This seems to absolute bonkers. We just had the wettest March since 1981. And they're talking about banning power showers now to get your water usage down by 20% to save the planet. I just crunched some numbers just now, Alan. So Rishi Sunak, the Prime Minister, has got his own private pool. 24,000 gallons of water that would have taken. Now, if you do some, you know, numbers on a spreadsheet, 5-minute power showers, probably about 1,700 showers to fill Rishi Sunak's pool. Why didn't people start talking about banning rich people having pools in their back garden rather than banning power showers? I think a lot of the public are being nudged and told to change their lifestyles, partly because of a lack of, and a failure for decades and decades. You know, the whole energy thing, we can probably talk about that another time or later, but the whole energy, the reason the cost of energy is so bad is because we haven't built any infrastructure for that as well. So the public are being paid, sorry, being kicked and are paying the price for government's kind of inefficiencies and lack of building of infrastructure the last 30 years.
They definitely are. I mean, you know, it's astonishing that we don't, unlike the Victorians, we don't seem to be able to build new pipes with for water and for nuclear and for IT cables. We could have a really big burrowing pipe building. I mean, we did get the Elizabeth line in London. That's good piece of infrastructure. It took, you know, maybe 30 years with the whole Crossrail project. It's been a disaster in many ways. Our ability is in America as well. There's a big issue with infrastructure and investing in energy and growth. The question of growth and productivity, it seems like that is not very fashionable now. But just from the point of view of the stats and everything, because I remember growing up, and in the dark ages of the 70s, global cooling was the big discussion. And then subsequently, you know, we saw pictures of the, I mean, obviously this has gone back to the Club of Rome and sustainable development and lots of ideas around this, Rachel Carson in the 60s. But where it became popularized is in the 90s, really, after the 80s, the late 80s and early 90s. But from a point of view of, this isn't just about stats, is it? Because even if you show stats of things, the question that most people ignore or don't think about is innovation, how we can innovate and transform. You know, we used to have horsepower, then we had the internal combustion engine. If you get nuclear fusion, you can do things in different ways. Why do you think that's sort of so morbidly never addressed?
No, you're right. So stats and the whole kind of climate debate as well. One of the things I think you've got to remember on this, because they'll say maybe the hottest ever recorded temperature in the United Kingdom, I think it was last summer. But you've got to remember, you know, I don't know, the Earth has been around for a long, long time, but the records only go back just over 100 years, Alan. So when you're talking about this is the hottest we've ever recorded, well, we haven't been recording for long. And if you put the start of Earth to where we are now, we're probably a little dot on a time scale. And even within that dot, we've only been, you know, we're not recording very far back. So that's my big concern when a lot of this debate around kind of the climate is all based on data that isn't very long in terms of the time series that we got. That's the first thing. But you're right, we there's no harm. The thing for me with a climate debate is that, and everybody wants clean energy. There's no harm in having wind farms. There's no harm in having solar farms. But you go back a couple of months ago in the winter, we had, Alan, we had a wind drought at the time, you know, where it was a freezing cold across the country and there wasn't enough wind. So what nature's telling you there is there's going to be a wind drought in 10, 20, 30, 40 years. You can't rely on wind for everything. It's dark at night, so you can't rely on solar. We would need a much better mix. And, you know, we've reduced, if you look at how much nuclear power we produce now, compared to the 1980s. We produced more then than we do now. How the hell have we got into a position where we've sleptwalked our way into this lack of energy security in the United Kingdom and in countries like Germany, which have been relying on foreign kind of imports? So yeah, innovation is definitely the key, that we need to innovate. It creates jobs, innovation as well. But you're right, the thing in terms of what you're saying, nobody's focusing on the kind of the positives that can come out of all of this. They're always talking about, you know, the doom and gloom negatives.
Well, I definitely want to get you back on the show to talk about energy at some point. I mean, France has got 60% nuclear and Sweden has about 35%. We need much more robust innovation and investment in infrastructure and R&D. If there's one thing that can be taken away from your point of view about any evidence-based policy, if one thing that you said could be written down and made sure that happened with anyone who came in, whatever the political color in politics, what would you say about that, about the data and stats and decision making and policy? What's your thought on that?
Yeah, so if you just take the pandemic, Alan, you know, when they were saying, you know, this is the model, and I think what we needed more of is, you know, some of these modelers at the time, people being able to ask those direct questions, challenge them, getting opposite views, all of that needs to be more in the public domain. And I think the one thing that we can learn from this as well is that, and it's good, like the TNT radio as well, the more media we've got, the more voices we hear rather than just kind of the mainstream. We need more robust challenge for evidence that's being used. And maybe we'll talk about it another time, but Sadiq Khan talked about 4,000 deaths a year to air pollution. You know, that was talked again on the BBC on the TV show last week. No challenge from the kind of presenters. That's the problem you've got. Journalists aren't challenging because they need the training as well to kind of pick up some fishy numbers.
Absolutely. And we've we've encouraged everyone to write into the BBC. I've written in, we've posted about that. But you're absolutely right, Jamie. And we need a big, thorough debate, because on the one hand, there's always numbers. And on the other hand, there's what we do about them. And that's called policy, and that's called politics. And that depends on judgment and thrashing out these ideas. It's great to have Jamie Jenkins on the show. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Alan Miller. This is TNT Radio. We'll be back in a moment with another exciting new guest. See you soon.
Give me a minute with TNT Radio's Steve Malzberg.
We have closely tracked the antics of CNN host Don Lemon in just the past few months. He was booted from his primetime evening show and planted between two female co-hosts early in the morning. Not long after that, he wore a hoodie under his suit jacket and the next day compared himself to Barack Obama, Trayvon Martin, and Zelensky. Then came his proclamation that women are past their prime after their 30s. But that's all nothing compared to what Variety describes in a new Lemon hit piece. In 2008, Lemon was co-hosting a show with Kyra Phillips. One night, she received a text which read, "Now you've crossed the line and you're going to pay for it." Variety says it was traced back to Don Lemon. They moved him off the show and back to weekends. Not long before that incident, he mocked colleague Nancy Grace on air by mimicking her. A person close to Grace tells Variety that she thinks he's an ass. And Lemon allegedly went after former CNNer Soledad O'Brien. During an editorial call, he suggested O'Brien isn't black. This after she got a gig hosting the CNN docuseries Black in America. So, why does this man still have a job at CNN? The story makes it pretty clear that he has cozied up to the right people. Can't wait to see what Don does next. Thanks for giving me a minute. I'm Steve Malzberg for TNT Radio.
Challenging the consensus and debunking the narrative. This is Viewpoint.
While the mainstream media peddles fear, thousands of prominent scientists are speaking out despite a near blackout in the mainstream media. For example, Clintel was founded in 2019 by Emeritus Professor of Geophysics Gus Berghout and science journalist Marcel Kroc. This global network of 900 scientists and professionals make the point that CO2 is not a pollutant. It is essential to all life on Earth. Photosynthesis is a blessing. More CO2 is beneficial for nature, greening the Earth. Additional CO2 in the air has promoted growth in global plant biomass. It is also good for agriculture, increasing the yields of crops worldwide.
You're listening to The Alan Miller Show on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back, everyone. I'm really pleased now for the next guest, because what we try and do every week is make sure we speak to campaigners up and down the country who we're working with or have made a dent or a mark on what's going on in their local community. Because in the end, that's what's really important, particularly as we're seeing with the measures and the discussions around so-called 15 or 20 minute neighbourhoods, which in the abstract is, you know, who wouldn't like a 15 minute neighbourhood? But then with all these measures that are going to mandate and impose things like impacts on cars and movement and low traffic neighbourhoods, LTNs and parking zones, clean air zones, ULEZ, all of those things. A lot of us saw what was going on in Thetford, because we saw my next guest speaking at the council hearing, going with many others to actually challenge and hold accountable their locally elected representatives, their local councillors. And some more exciting news is happening there as well, which we'll get into. But I'd love to welcome Mike Ball to the show. Hello, Mike. How are you?
Alan, good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Great for you to be here. So, Mike, just briefly, because tell us how this all came about. Tell us the first steps, what you did, and what's happening in Thetford, in Norfolk, and what's going on, if you would.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, no problem at all. Basically, we were made aware that of a decision that was made by the Norfolk County Council on the 13th of December 22, that they had voted in favour of investigation and research for the County of Norfolk to become a 20-minute neighbourhood county. We were made aware of that some month later, a little over a month, on the 24th of January, in a press release from the East End Daily Press, which is a county newspaper. Obviously, that was the first time that we'd any knowledge of the situation. We'd had no consultation. There'd been no public consultation. Our views and thoughts weren't even considered. So it was then that we took the opportunity at an alternative council meeting, which was about allotments in the town, to go there and question the mayor, Jane James, as to why, in her capacity as a Norfolk County councillor, she had chosen to vote without consultation or consideration from the residents.
Yeah, and what, remind us of her answer.
Well, basically, she said that she'd voted at that time in a capacity for investigation and research, but you know, she didn't really give a definitive answer, Alan, in relation to why she hadn't consulted. It was merely at that time to investigate and to research. But we kind of know, you know, we're not stupid people. We know what that means. You know, that's the implementation of a policy, but that's how they cover it, isn't it?
And so, I mean, for people not familiar with Norfolk, Norfolk, large, very rural in many places. Obviously, it has cities within it, but you know, it's a different conversation to something that's going on in London, for instance, right? So, you know, there you could say, well, there definitely are things right down the road. In many ways, the idea that in Norfolk, this attack on the car, which often is what ends up happening, because it's presented in terms of livable streets or active travel or service provision that's close by, and yet services haven't improved and often they've gone downhill. But what is on the agenda is limiting or restricting or fining or charging. What has been the response so far? Because you've now organised much more. Tell us where you've got to. You've done another council meeting, and you've also got some people. There's some people are standing independently, aren't they?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, Norfolk is a beautiful county. There's no two ways about it. The one thing about it is the fact that it is rural. We've got a lot of forest land, and we've got a lot of isolated villages. And that in itself is actually a beautiful thing for any county to have. We have got developments, and obviously we've got large towns and we've got cities, etc. I mean, Thetford is within the district at Breckland, which is the council that controls us. As a district council, we are the biggest town in that district. We've got a population of around about 30,000 people. But yeah, I mean, you know, within 5-minute drive, you're off into the country, and you're in that country for a long time before you come to a neighbouring town. So from that point of view, it is, you know, it is beautiful. And it's, I just don't see the necessity of implementing a 20-minute neighbourhood. And I think, you know, logistically, it's going to be an absolute nightmare, and it's going to be very, very expensive. With regard to that, I mean, one of the things that come out, we went on to have an emergency council meeting that was with Norfolk County Council, because the initial one was just the town council where we initially challenged Jane James. That was town council, so it's very small. The county council came down. There were four members on the panel, of which Jane James was one, and a local a town councillor, Terry Jeremy, was another. Tom McCabe, who's effectively the CEO of Norfolk County Council, and then Lana Hempsall, who come down to explain the policy, because she was actually one of the sort of like the implementers of the policy. So they come down and they were questioned by us and residents on the night. There was 300 in the hall. It was capacity full. And then obviously it was streamed online. So, but one of the things that came out in that meeting that was, you know, alarming really, is Norfolk County Council is currently £66 million in debt. £66 million, Alan. I mean, that's not like, you know, it's not an oversight. I mean, that is huge. Yet they're talking about bringing infrastructure in, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, you just think to yourself, well, it just doesn't seem feasible. So what you look at is, where's the remuneration for the policy going to come from? And I think you're right, 100%. You know, it's the most lucrative industry in any business at the moment seems to be the motorist. And I think we are going to get, well, we will get clobbered. There's no two ways about that.
So the, I mean, I'm a big fan of Norfolk. I'm often up there in different areas. We've got a lot of good friends there. It is stunning. It is beautiful. And the thing is that this lack of consultation, this lack of debate and sort of doing any kind of assessment evaluation with what people think, with how things can play out, but a kind of blanket, this is what we're going to do, seems to be the order of the day. But they've got a bit of a bloody nose, haven't they? Because what's so fantastic, Mike, is that you and others have come along and stood up and said, well, actually, we're going to hold elected representatives accountable. We're going to ask them questions. They might be thorny and difficult. We're going to live stream it so other people are going to see. And I would really recommend this to everyone. I mean, it's inspiring when you see Mike and others doing this. You see it around the country that people are saying, well, hold on a minute. You're doing this in our name, but we haven't even discussed it in many places. And where we have discussed it, often you've ignored us when we have had consultations that have been very loaded. I think it's really, really important. But you're actually going one stage further now, aren't you? Tell us a bit about that with people standing independently.
Yeah, we've got, I mean, pretty much off the back of the meetings and obviously the awareness campaign that we've launched in the town. I mean, I have to be honest. I mean, I'm very, very fortunate. I'm supported massively, not only as a result of the video going out, but in the town itself. I've lived here 46 years and I'm a well-respected member of the town. I've had businesses here, barber shops, etc. So I have a large contact point with the community and I love my town. There's no two ways about that. And I'm extremely passionate about my town. And for somebody to come into it and make a decision for us residents without a consultation, I think was it was just insulting. And we now need to make a difference. And what we've done is we've managed to get 13 independent councillors standing. So they will stand, 13 will stand if elected, and hopefully they will be. And I'm pushing that campaign for all of them. I'm not personally standing because I've got a different route that I want to take. And I think I would have constraints put around me that if the council would have a decision on how I portray myself, which will always be professional, but it might not be to their liking. So what we've done is we've got 13 independents standing, of which 8 of those 13 will go on to district level as well. So we will have a voice. And that's where my passion comes from, Alan, is, you know, for so long, we, the public, have never had a voice. We've always had to, it's always been implied consent, or people just say, well, that's just how it is. I don't hear that, and I will not hear that, because my life is my life. My family's life is their lives, you know, and for somebody to come in that doesn't even know us and just in a public office position think they can make my decisions for me. No, that's not going to happen. And she was told in no uncertain terms. She was going to stand, ironically, Jane James, the mayor, was going to stand for local council. But a couple of days after the meeting where I told her, you know, that if you're going to continue to make these decisions, I'll make it my personal mission to make sure you don't get elected. And she pulled out.
Wow. That's so interesting. I mean, it's so good to hear that someone who, because often we're told these things, aren't we? We these names are put out, right? They're one of these types of people, or they're a conspiracist, or they're this, far this, or extreme that. But actually, as you say, you've been in that community, you're well-respected, you had business, you've got a family there. And this is the thing, I think there's a lack of willingness to debate the merit of the ideas. Because if you really believe in something and the virtue of something, really what they should be doing is explaining why it's so brilliant and winning you over to the position, rather than what we've seen quite often, which is trying to do things behind closed doors or name call. We know certainly that Sadiq Khan likes to name call the public. And in many parts of the country, that's been the case in Oxford and elsewhere. But because what you've done, Mike, a couple of things have happened. One is that other people in different parts of the country will look at that and go, God, well, we can do that actually here. And every time someone does that, it spells a lie to the stuff that some lazy journalists want to repeat without interrogating the idea, and people put out as kind of a sort of smear campaign to not engage those ideas. So it's really, really fantastic that you're doing it. And we should remind everyone that obviously now the deadline's closed to stand, but quite a lot of people are standing independently around the UK on the May 4th local elections. And, you know, if people are standing on a freedom basis, on a basis that, you know, they're either single issue, it might be challenging low traffic neighbourhoods or 15-minute neighbourhood, or on the basis of freedom, whoever is doing that, we encourage everyone at Together and all our friends in Britain, in the public, the media, and everyone to support those candidates who actually takes courage to do that, and it takes some commitment. So I want to thank you, Mike. And we're going to see you next week, aren't we?
Yeah, I'm humbled, to be honest with you. I mean, it would only ever have been a dream with me. You know, I've sat here for 3 years listening to the, you know, the mainstream media, and it's just following a narrative. You can see that they're all bought and paid for. I don't care what anyone says. You know, the one thing about me that you'll see, Alan, to be honest with you, I've lost the fear of a consequence. I really don't care anymore. I'm never going to be unprofessional, but I've got a voice and I'll use it and I'll stand up for people. And the only thing that is ever going to defeat this, and just very quickly, you know, I was looking this morning, if you go back in time to, I mean, the 31st of March, 1990, the Poltex riots. Well, whilst I don't condone in any way civil unrest, and I don't agree with that, what I do think is I just look at that and I think to myself that policy was overturned. But why was the policy overturned? Was it because a few shops were smashed up or there was a bit of damage, et cetera, et cetera? And I don't believe that to be true. I think the policy was overturned because the people had just decided they'd had enough and they united. And that is literally, you know, to quote your thing, get together. And that's exactly what you got to do. And now we are finding that. Me on my own, I would be defeated in no time whatsoever at any council meeting. But I've got the support of the network of the community. Get the support and network of your community. Get in touch with me. I'm looking to get a YouTube channel so that I can get this message out there. Unity is the only way that we'll ever defeat this. We are the people and we are the power and we are the biggest fear for them. There's no two ways about that. If we rise up and we challenge them in mass, you know, and just almost a lawful non-compliance. You don't have to put up with this. And people forget that. We don't have to put up with this. We have got a voice and we should use them.
Brilliant, Mike. Thanks for joining today. It is really, really good to hear Mike speaking so passionately. That was Mike Ball in Thetford in Norfolk. And if you want to hear some more from Mike and a lot of other people, you should join us next Saturday at Trafalgar Square from 12 midday till 3 p.m. We're going to have a range of speakers that are going to be announced next week. Lots of really good people speaking, talking about the challenge to and the action on ULEZ. We do not want to see ULEZ extended. Sadiq Khan has bought the ANPR cameras before he even did the consultation. He's ignored over 65% in the first round of the consultations, as well as 5,000 respondents that he didn't think were the right kind of respondents. And in addition to that, he's now lying, saying that 4,000 people a year die from cars, and it's nonsense. He knows it. Transport for London knows it as well. Meanwhile, they're doling out money to local authorities, but holding it back from Tower Hamlets because they want to nudge and enforce and impose road closures, of all things. Transport for London and road closures. Who'd have thought it? But people are not having it. Like Mike says, people are standing up. They're getting together. We're getting together across London, and there's a range of council leaders and MPs and residents and businesses, but it's ordinary people, us, the people that make Britain work, that have been having our voices heard in every town and city up and down the country where these things have been happening. Many of them will be joining us to talk our next Saturday at Trafalgar Square from 12 o'clock onwards. We've got people coming from lots of different cities where people have been campaigning and challenging, people that have been on this show like Cheyenne from Cambridge, and we've got people from Oxford and Bath and Canterbury and up and down the country from Manchester and elsewhere, all people coming to speak and show some solidarity, because it's not what they want us to hear, which is, what are you doing here? This isn't your area. You shouldn't be talking about this. Actually, we're all British residents. We're all British citizens. And we have common interests in making sure we have the best kind of governance, the best policies, the best planning and measures for what we need, not on the basis of fear and imposition and nudge and fining and stealth taxes, but on our freedom and our ability to work things out to create growth, productivity and development. And that's what the Together Cabinet is going to be doing as it launches in the coming period too. It's been a great show. Thanks for being with us today. I'm Alan Miller. Thank you to my guests, Jay Bhattacharya, Jamie Jenkins, and thanks, of course, at the very end to Mike Ball from Thetford. I'll see you next Saturday. Have a great week. Carry on being free. Stand together always. We're always stronger and better together.